Support for WGTD's morning show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenosians who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and occasional morning show co-host. And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Part one of today's program, a brand new novel from Bert Solomon called The Murder of Willie Lincoln. In part two, we'll hear from the archives Jacqueline Tobin talking about her fascinating book, From Midnight to Dawn, which explores one phase of the Underground Railroad and how slaves would escape from the American South all the way to Canada. Stay with us. It isn't all that often that I explore a work of fiction on the morning show, and most of the time there has to be something very compelling that draws me away from nonfiction to the world of fiction, and I'm certainly delighted that I explored a book that, just from its very premise, intrigued me very much, and it proved to be every bit as fine as I expected it to be. A novel called The Murder of Willie Lincoln. The title is intriguing, of course, because there is no mention in history books of Willie Lincoln, one of the sons of our 16th president, ever being murdered. But what if Willie Lincoln, in fact, did not die of typhoid fever, but in fact was murdered during those bitter days of the Civil War? That is the premise behind this new novel by Bert Solomon, a highly regarded writer, a contributing editor to The Atlantic and for the National Journal. He has covered politics, the White House, and won awards for his reporting. He has really done something superb with this new book published by Forge. And I'm very, very excited to be able to speak with Bert Solomon for the next few minutes about his book, again called The Murder of Willie Lincoln, a novel. Bert Solomon, we welcome you to the morning show.
Oh, thanks so much for having me. A pleasure to be here.
One of the reasons I am especially intrigued by your novel is because, in many respects, the central character is John Hay, someone who was very close to Abraham Lincoln, one of his closest, most trusted and treasured aides, and someone who has a powerful connection locally here as a former alum of Carthage College, where I teach on the music faculty. So the fact that John Hay figures really in the central role of your novel is just endlessly delightful for me, and I know it will be for many other listeners around here. Tell us about your initial encounter with John Hay and what drew you to him to make him the central protagonist in your novel.
Well, it's funny. I was sitting at a blank computer screen one morning, staring at it, writing nonfiction, which is what I ordinarily do, and an idea popped into my head, a murder mystery in the Lincoln White House. Okay, I love murder mysteries. I love Lincoln. Yeah, I thought this would be really fun. And the next instant, another idea popped into my head, which is John Hay as the detective. I didn't even know I knew who the guy was, but he turns out to be a 23-year-old assistant private secretary to Lincoln and almost another son to Lincoln who lived in the White House, who did a lot of his correspondence, who did all sorts of stuff. There was, the whole White House staff was like 2.5 people. And he was a very cool and fun guy. He was witty, he was bright, he was irreverent, he was skeptical, even cynical. He brought a measure of kind of levity, lightness to a White House that was just mired in tragedy. I mean, the war and the reports from the battlefield and men being killed, and it looked like an endless war at this point. It was not even a year into it. And Hay just turns out to be one, a bright guy, an orderly mind. He had just been passed the bar in Illinois, though he never practiced law, but also a published poet and a thoughtful guy, and so fairly intuitive and willing to think outside the box. And so I think that made him into an ideal detective. If Willie Lincoln had indeed been murdered, I think that John Hay is the fellow that Lincoln would have turned to look into it.
Mm. Let's talk about it, namely the possibility of Willie Lincoln being murdered rather than dying of natural causes. But let's first talk about what actually happened as far as the historical record is concerned. Until you wrote your novel, who was Willie Lincoln and how did his life end, at least as far as we know?
Willie Lincoln was Lincoln's 11-year-old son, the middle son, who was a delightful young fellow. He was, again, also very bright. He's very comfortable with adults and with children as well. He was, you know, did a lot of pranks, and he was up to a lot of no good as a leader. But he was also a very serious kid who got along with adults and he got along with children. And as I say, and he was the son who was most like Lincoln in terms they had an inner life. Their gestures were similar. There's a lovely little anecdote which I use in this book, where Willie is trying to puzzle through some problem, and Lincoln is standing there, sitting there, watching him do this for about 10 minutes. And at the end of the 10 minutes, Willie sort of lights up, and he has figured it out. And Lincoln says, "I know the process by which this boy is thinking this stuff through, because it's the same process that I go through. And now you see, he has figured it out in the same way that I would have figured it out." And so they were, in a way, soulmates. You know, I don't think that's too strong. And so his death was a terrible tragedy for the family. And what happened is in early February, he came down became ill, as did his brother Ted, his younger brother, who's 8 years old. And the doctors thought it was typhoid fever, though they weren't entirely sure. They thought it might be something called bilious fever, which was somewhat related. Obviously, the medical care then was not what it is now. And so they treated him for typhoid fever, you know, in every way that they could, though Lincoln did not allow them to use leeches, which was a common, you know, prescription at the time. Shortly after 5 o'clock on February 20th, 1862, Willie Lincoln died.
One of the ways in which you do such a beautiful way of describing this event is to help us sort of follow the ebb and flow of this illness and what seems like signs of hope, and then suddenly it all comes crashing to the floor. And one thing that is intriguing, too, is that you have your central character, John Hay, first alerted to what's happened when he hears a cry of anguish. And that cry of anguish is from Abraham Lincoln himself. And it's so interesting to think about our 16th president immortalized in statues and on the $5 bill and so on. I mean, one of the towering figures of our history crying out in anguish. We know he was a human being, and yet somehow to see him in this most wrenching of personal tragedies, he becomes more human than most of us ever think of him as.
Well, one of the things that is so appealing about Lincoln is how human he is. We tend to think of George Washington as marble, right? There's no sense of him as a real person. Lincoln is very much a real person, and I think that's one of the things people just love about him. Those things about, you know, about him crying out in anguish when he died, those are all accurate. And his sobbing through his hands, those are accurate. I took those from real descriptions, contemporaneous descriptions, and so I didn't make that stuff up. And the idea that he could both fight a war and deal with his overwhelming grief and do both at the same time, gave me even more respect for Lincoln than I started out with.
We're speaking with Bert Solomon, whose novel is called The Murder of Willie Lincoln. You have sought to create a novel that is very strongly rooted in the historic record. Give our listeners some sense of the extent to which this is true. I mean, the number of in a sense real people from actual history who are part of your novel, and also actual events from the historical record that have been folded into this work of fiction.
My idea was here, since I am a journalist and written three nonfiction books, and I was a little wary about writing a novel as to whether I could pull this off, and so I made it close to real life as I could, and that involved just a huge amount of research. What I love about history is immersing myself in it till I feel like I'm there, and that takes research, because I want the reader to feel like that too. And so I tried to vividly portray Washington, or Washington City as it was known, in 1862. And some of it is similar to now. A lot of the buildings are still here. The Capitol was there at the time, without a dome. And the Washington Monument was there, though it was only one-third the height because they had run out of money. I tried to get, you know, through reading of newspapers and diaries and memoirs and magazine articles and everything I could get my hands on, a feeling of, you know, the hogs who were eating from the gutter, you know, which were really there. If your listeners are familiar with Washington, where Constitution Avenue is now running along the northern edge of the mall, used to be what they called Tiber Creek, and then it became a canal, and then it really was an open sewer so that you could smell it. And John Hay, living in the White House, which was just a couple of blocks away from this open sewer, said it smelled like 10,000 dead cats. So Washington was recognizable in certain ways. The political dynamics haven't changed at all, except the decimal points have moved some in terms of the money being thrown around. But in many ways, it was different than it is now, and I tried very hard to show those differences, because that's what I love doing, is what I care about.
Right. I really like that. I had not heard the expression before that you share at one point, that Washington, D.C. in this era was known as the city of magnificent distances. Explain what that phrase means. It's so intriguing.
Well, I can't recall actually who said that, but it was it was distances between, say, the Capitol and the White House, with almost nothing in between. And so there were these sort of oddly scattered formal buildings that hadn't kind of grown into itself. A few years ago, I went to Canberra, Australia, which is the kind of invented capital of Australia, and felt and had the feeling that this was like Washington, you know, 200 years ago, where there's these sort of widely scattered formal buildings that haven't quite grown into a city. Washington at the time was that, and there were swamps kind of in between all these areas. It was literally a swamp to be drained at the time.
Right. It's, of course, in the midst of this most bitter moment in our history, the Civil War. Our nation is divided in two. And I think one of the smartest things you do in the way you put this novel together is when you have Abraham Lincoln believing that were the news to get out into the public that Willie had been murdered rather than dying of natural causes, that news would further divide the nation. That felt entirely plausible and entirely real to me.
Well, Lincoln is thinking in this story that if people find out that the secessionists who are believed at the beginning to be behind this murdered his son, it would just set up all sorts of anger and fears and ambitions, you know, on the various sides of this. And then he says, you know, if this happened, where in the bloodstained earth would this anger and hostility ever end? And so I think that it would make sense that he would not want that known. There were a number of things that were going on in the White House at the time that he really did not want known. He had some sense of, you know, kind of political public relations, if you will. Some of them involved his wife, who was doing some things that she probably should not have done. And they did not want publicly known. This is all true. And so I used all this in a, you know, nonfiction/fiction way. And he just had a sense of the dignity of the office And what would happen if that dignity was, you know, undercut?
You paint a beautiful portrait of President Lincoln and of the relationship between President Lincoln and John Hay. And it is a complex relationship, very, very close, yet not quite a friendship. And at one point, you have John Hay actually feeling, in his words, protective toward this man who towered over me, almost as if he, John Hay, were the adult and Lincoln the awkward naif. Say more about that relationship and that aspect of their relationship.
Lincoln, both of them came from Illinois, and John Hay was from a town on the Mississippi River, so at the western edge of Illinois. So in certain ways, their backgrounds were quite similar. But John Hay had the advantage, actually sort of through his uncle, who was a lawyer in Springfield, sharing the same office space with Lincoln. And he went to Brown University in the East, in Providence. And at the beginning, he was considered by the Easterners at Brown the sort of outlander Westerner who they did not respect. And so he had to basically earn their respect. And he kind of became an Anglophile and a sort of transplanted Easterner. And so he had a sort of a refined sense of, you know, culture. And we'll go to salons as well as boxing places, boxing gyms in Providence. Lincoln never had those kinds of experiences, which would have made him, if you will, more sort of sophisticated. And so Lincoln didn't care for what anybody thought. So his sleeves were too short, you know, and his socks were mismatched, and he didn't care. He read a lot, but whereas Hay's reading was, you know, quite widespread, Lincoln basically confined himself to the Bible and Shakespeare, as well as a little bit of poetry. And he read the same things again and again and again, and took them in deeply. But he was not, he just knew nothing really beyond Illinois or, you know, the Mississippi or the Ohio River. And he hadn't been many places. He hadn't seen many things. He didn't know much about cities. He didn't know much about women. There's a large pieces of the world that he knew very little about and didn't really care that much about. So in a way, that's why Hay would regard him as an awkward naif, for his sort of lack of caring about these worldly things that Hay cared a lot and maybe too much about.
Right. And it's also intriguing that John Hay, who is entrusted with investigating whether or not a murder has occurred, is someone who is very, very intelligent, cares about this assignment deeply, and yet has no experience as an investigator. So he is not perfectly assured. And I think that's one thing, too, that makes him the perfect choice to do this versus an experienced detective in doing one more investigation, open and shut, I mean, proceeding smoothly to the conclusion. This is a much more interesting road because it's a bumpier road for John Hay.
He was not a very good detective, I must say. He was a little bit inept, and so he kept trying things and kind of coming to dead ends. And one of the people who was in the story, who was real, basically everybody in the story is real, is Alan Pinkerton, the well-known detective who founded the detective agency that we still know about, who had also come east with Lincoln when he came out from Illinois. And so Lincoln tells Hay that, you know, you got to let Pinkerton have a role, and John Hay kind of wants to fend him off because Pinkerton is kind of an overbearing, you know, jerk in many ways. But he does, in fact, go to Pinkerton for help at various times when he needs it. But Hay is persistent. And so when he tries something and that doesn't work, he sort of goes back to the drawing board and tries to figure out, you know, what the next step would be, and he figures out the next step. And so he goes through and talks about, you know, learns about the secessionists who were all over the White House and through the government. And almost everybody in the story, including Mary Lincoln and including others, become at least briefly a suspect.
Right. And, of course, he's following the trail, in a sense, in two different ways. from the outside into the center, and also trying to retrace the chronological arc of time from beginning to the end. It's just so intriguing to imagine such a thing. And of course, also back in the year 1862, before there's an internet to Google and other modern conveniences that would make such investigation more doable. Say a quick word, if you would, about the brief samples that we get through your novel of John Hay's beautiful writing, particularly his work as a poet.
Well, he was a class poet at Brown in a very long, like 360-some line poem that I found pretty impenetrable. And he wrote, actually he became successful as a poet after 1862 by doing sort of the dialect of the frontier of Illinois. And he did a couple of articles, or a couple of poems, I must say, for a New York newspaper that he worked for that caught on and became published and became, a big deal. And so he actually was quite successful as that, though he was never proud of that poetry. I'm not a big fan of his poetry. I mean, I've been reading through it. It's more a matter of taste. It's a little ornate for my taste and so forth. And one of my friends suggested when I wanted to make him a poet, make him a bad poet. that's really a good idea, because I kind of think he was, and it's way easier to write. and so I have one scene where the girl, Kate Chase, who is the daughter of the Treasury Secretary, who he really has the hots for, and they're sitting at a grand banquet in the Secretary of State's home table, and she says across the way, "Okay, write a poem now. What's the subject?" "Me." He said, oh my, there's no way I can come out of this head. And so he's trying to think of lines. And some of the lines I've used in the book are his, or his poetry, and other ones I've made up, including that one.
It gives this wonderful novel just one more sort of layer of life and vitality. And it's really a terrific mystery, and I enjoyed it start to finish. Again, it's titled The Murder of Willie Lincoln, published by Forge, and the author, Bert Solomon. Bert Solomon, congratulations on an absolutely wonderful novel, and I look forward to the novels that will follow after it. And I thank you for joining me today on The Morning Show.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it. I enjoyed it. Thank you.
For part two of today's Morning Show, Jacqueline Tobin, and a portion of our conversation where she talks about her book, From Midnight to Dawn, The Last Tracks of the Underground Railroad, telling the memorable story of how some slaves from the American South managed to escape not only the South, but escaped the borders of the United States itself to settle in Canada, in settlements created especially as places of refuge for escaping slaves.
You mentioned, I think maybe in the preface or introduction to the book, that the story of these communities in Canada, made up almost entirely of former slaves, is a story that has been almost completely untold, unknown in America, and you say until recently, even in Canada, a largely untold story. For any particular reason?
Well, certainly in America, I think that we have a tendency to believe our history begins and ends at our borders. In terms of Canadian history, what I've come to learn is that the black population in Canada is such a minority that many people don't even know that they have a long history in their country. So I think those two factors combined on both sides of this international border.
Is there any particular reason that you came to know about this?
Well, it was actually while I was doing research for Hidden in Plain View that I had a wonderful African-American gentleman call me up and say, "Have you ever been to Buxton?" And I said, "No, I don't know where Buxton is." And he said, "Well, it's in Ontario, Canada." And he said, "You must go to Buxton." And I didn't make it there for several years. It was actually after publication of Hidden in Plain View that I finally got up there in the year 2000. And I went up there over Labor Day weekend when they were celebrating their welcoming home. It's called Homecoming, and it's a welcoming home of the descendants of all these former slaves that return to Buxton every year to celebrate their heritage. And I was so astounded by what I was learning about their heritage and their story that not only was I intrigued enough to want to write about it, but I've been going back there for 7 years, every year on Homecoming. I now consider it part of my homecoming as well.
Tell us again exactly where Buxton is.
If you cross over into Canada from Detroit and you go over into Windsor, you can go straight up about 60 miles and you will hit the town of Chatham, and you will also about 12 miles away hit the small community of North Buxton. Buxton was actually divided into North and South Buxton eventually. And you will then go, you can go to the west, and you can also come up upon the community of Dresden, which was once near the black settlement called Dawn.
Mm. In fact, let's take this moment to explain the title of your book. I mean, this is just wonderful. Again, the title is From Midnight to Dawn. Tell our listeners exactly what that title means, besides the poetic beauty of it.
Well, I was very fortunate to come up with such a title. It just exactly fit, and it hit me when I was driving across the country one day, and I said, oh my goodness, this is the title for the book. So that's always exciting to a writer when this happens. But in this case, Midnight was the code name for Detroit on the Underground Railroad. And Dawn, as I just mentioned, was the name of a black settlement near the community now known as Dresden that was settled by blacks up in Canada. So you have this poetic name, and which can, of course, be read on many levels, from Midnight, Detroit, across the international border into Canada towards Dawn, the advent of a new life, a new beginning, but also the name of a black settlement in Ontario.
Hmm. Fascinating. So let's dig into some of the specifics of this story. First of all, briefly, we should talk about how the situation for slaves in America kind of changed over the course of the years, and certain attitudes began changing, certain laws began to be enacted, fugitive laws and the like, which really changed day-to-day life for slaves and sort of reshaped their attitudes about it and whether or not it made sense for them to attempt an escape. Just talk a moment about that.
Well, I think there are a couple of things, and what I had to ask myself was, why Canada? How did Canada end up becoming the land of Canaan, if you will, for fugitive slaves? And in this case, what we find out is that Great Britain, Canada was then called British North America before the Civil War. Great Britain had already abolished slavery in 1833. As a little side, we are this month actually celebrating the 200th anniversary of the ending of the slave trade in Britain. And for those of your listeners who want to find out more about that, I really urge them to go see this amazing movie out telling that story, and it's called Amazing Grace, which should be in your theaters right now, if I'm not mistaken. But
I think that's right.
It tells the story of how these wealthy, influential men banded together and tried to end the slave trade. And it was absolutely revolutionary for them to do or even to consider such an idea, because historically slavery had always been a part of various cultures around the world. So for them to actually force this issue and create this movement, this anti-slavery movement, was huge, but it began in Britain. Britain at the time, of course, was also the largest slave trading country, so it makes sense that there would be someone who would finally realize that this was necessary to end such an institution. In the United States, though, what happened to eventually start pushing more and more blacks to try to reach freedom in Canada was about, I would suggest that it was the 1850 Fugitive Slave Act. And this was an act that allowed slave owners to actually cross over into northern states, which had already abolished slavery for the most part, and go try to recapture those slaves that had escaped and bring them back to the South. and this was now provided by law. They now had the support of law to go after their former slaves. So it was no longer safe for blacks to just reach freedom in the north part of the U.S. They now had to actually cross an international boundary, that international border, and into what we now know as Canada, if they were to at least be supported by legislation that allowed them to live freely.
Hmm. I think we should mention something else, which is sort of a sad thing or regrettable thing to mention, but I think it's very helpful to our really comprehensive understanding of this. You talk in the chapter about the community of Wilberforce in Canada about what attitudes were like in Ohio in the 1820s and 1830s. And some of what you talk about resonates very powerfully with attitudes with which we're living very much today. Tell us what life was like in Ohio in the early part of the 19th century, and what it meant for the blacks who fled there.
Well, what you're referencing is the fact that Ohio had already abolished slavery in 1802. So you had this state that was, by law, a free state, but it's also bordering across the river with a slave state, the state of Kentucky. So you had a lot of escaping slaves trying to reach freedom in Ohio. You saw a mass influx of blacks moving into the state of Ohio, particularly the Cincinnati area. And what began happening is Ohio got very nervous about this mass influx of immigration. And as you suggested, many of the lessons that we discover, all the different trials and tribulations that were occurring up north with these newly freed black people up in Canada, there are similar lessons that are still going on with us today. So I find that fairly ironic, and you touched on that. But in Ohio, what the legislature considered doing is they started enforcing black codes, which were very, very harsh restrictions put on even free black people in Ohio in order to try to control them, because they began be so worried about the influx of these fugitives into their state. Well, the free blacks in Ohio banded together, as it made sense to do so, and tried to protect themselves. But when they began seeing the writing on the wall, that with the escalating pressure on them and escalating threats of violence, in some cases certainly violence, what they did is they sent certain delegates into Canada and said, is there land for us to buy up there that we could move and become a part of a free country and live freely without these threats up there? Mm. Well, the people of Cincinnati didn't wait for the folks to come back. They actually began the mob violence, and what happened is you saw an outflux of certain groups of blacks outside of the Cincinnati area, and some of those same folks ended up in Canada and began a community, the first black settlement called Wilberforce.
You tell us about that terrible event, that mob violence in 1829 in the summer, 3 days of violence directed against the black community, and over 1,500 African Americans end up really fleeing for their lives. I'm so struck by a quote you shared with us from a fugitive slave named John Malvin. And he writes, "I thought upon coming to a free state like Ohio that I would find every door thrown open to receive me. But from the treatment I received by the people generally, I found it little better than Virginia." I mean, it's sobering indeed. And we get so sad when we think about a former slave freeing from the South, fleeing from the South, hoping to find welcoming arms, and not finding that kind of welcome at all, at least in this pocket of the North.
Well, and you also find a new definition of freedom now being demanded by those formerly enslaved blacks who did find freedom under the law, at least. They were now demanding freedom of equality and opportunity, and this was something that white people, even in the North, got very nervous about. It was one thing to free formerly enslaved people, but to give them the same opportunities and the same equality under the law was something they hadn't quite accepted yet. So the whole definition of freedom was becoming more expansive at this same particular time.
That brings to mind another interesting shift mentioned in the same chapter, I think. You talk about how African Americans in the early 19th century still very much thought of themselves as Africans, and that there was even a group, I think, called the American Colonization Society, which really existed, I think, to hopefully repatriate some of these slaves or freed slaves back to Africa. Before too long, that became something that most of the blacks here in North America weren't really interested in being returned to the continent of Africa.
And what you're referring to here is the American Colonization Society, which was begun by people such as Henry Clay on one end of the spectrum and Bushrod Washington, a nephew of George Washington, thought that, well, maybe we can do away with this whole threatening issue of slavery if we just try to repatriate these Africans back to Africa. Well, they established the country of Liberia in 1817, but shortly after that, blacks started seeing themselves and identifying themselves more as Americans and did not want to be repatriated. And so this whole huge issue of immigration versus being immigrated took on huge connotations in the black community.
Hmm.
And there were great arguments on both sides of the spectrum, some believing that, yes, it was good to go out and find a new place to live in another country, perhaps our motherland of Africa. Others said, no, I am American. I have been here now our families have been here for three or four generations, and I consider myself an American.
Well, and in your book, a freed slave in the North is quoted as saying, many of our fathers and some of us have fought and bled for the liberty, independence, and peace which you now enjoy. Surely it would be ungenerous and unfeeling in you to deny us a humble and quiet grave in that country which gave us birth.
Absolutely. And again, I can go back into the first precedent we see of people moving into Canada actually began at the end of the American Revolution. And this began because the British, during that conflict that we were having with this country called Great Britain at the time, were using a military tactic. They were saying, okay, if you escape, or they would actually free slaves of lands in the South that they would capture, and they said to these newly freed blacks, if you fight for us, we will give you your freedom. Well, this was a military tactic and not necessarily on any belief in anti-slavery upon the British at that particular time, but they used it as a military tactic during the American Revolution to impact the manpower being used by especially the southern states. So we saw that tactic. Now, what's interesting about that tactic as a little side here is that Abraham Lincoln used that same tactic later on during the Civil War when he offered the Emancipation Proclamation, which did not, contrary to popular opinion, free all the slaves. It actually only freed those slaves in those states that were threatening to secede from the Union. So it was more a military tactic at that point by Lincoln than it was benevolence on his part.
Hmm. That's one of the most interesting shades of this story, isn't it? That sometimes maybe evil things were done, not always for evil reasons, sometimes just out of plain fear, and sometimes good things were done for not the most impressive or laudable of reasons. I mean, there is so much gray in the story of how the early United States of America lived with the institution of slavery.
Well, and again, I keep coming back to this whole concept of these British abolitionists, these first British abolitionists like William Wilberforce, and beginning to understand just how revolutionary this concept of abolishing slavery really was at this time in history.
Hmm.
Because down through history, people, cultures had always enslaved those that they had captured and given them some form of indentured servitude or slavery. But it wasn't really until we began bringing a particular group of people, and those were the black people from Africa, over into our North and South American and Caribbean areas, that we began to see the color line in this whole issue of slavery. And that's when it took on a whole different tone than it used to.
I think ahead of us talking briefly about a couple of these specific settlements, I think we should also maybe remind people of this thing called the Underground Railroad, which of course helped to facilitate escaping blacks, escaping slaves, helped them, facilitated this journey from the South all the way to perhaps Canada for some of them, that we should not think of the Underground Railroad as more or less than actually what it was. I mean, this is not what we sometimes tend to think of as a highly organized system. I mean, it was loosely organized, if it was organized really at all, and yet it was the lifeline upon which so many slaves depended.
Well, and I'm glad you're trying to help redefine that, because scholars in the past 20 years have certainly come to understand that this Underground Railroad, this idea of the Underground Railroad that certainly I grew up with, of these benevolent white people helping these poor slaves escape, that's what I call the romantic version of the Underground Railroad, when in essence I now try to speak of the Underground Railroad as a resistance movement that began when the first chains were put on blacks in Africa, and resistance took many forms, and one of those forms was escape. And again, contrary to popular opinion, they weren't just waiting on plantations, waiting to be saved by benevolent white people.
Right. You say, when an underground railroad was laid on the paths first trod by courageous forebears who had escaped without any white assistance, many of the conductors, so-called conductors of that underground railroad, were free blacks. Elsewhere in the book, I think in the preface, you say, what has come to be known as the Underground Railroad was less an organized system than a corridor of subterfuge and chance. There was no easy path out of slavery to freedom. For a few of them, of course, they did indeed find their way to Canada, and one of the first such communities settled was called Wilberforce. Ultimately, I guess we would say not a successful community, in that it really didn't live on. It died out for maybe a mix of reasons, and yet you say this is an important name in this whole movement and was a symbol of hope for many blacks.
It absolutely was, because when you consider the definition of success, I'd like to redefine it when we talk about Wilberforce. This was absolutely the first black settlement to be instituted by blacks themselves for their own freedom, which I think is an important, it was self-determination at its best, saying we are going to determine our and control our futures. We are going into Canada. We are going to establish a community. So that the failure of success of Wilberforce is not whether it succeeded and lived on forever, but that it existed at all. And not only that, but that abolitionists throughout the world looked at Wilberforce and said it can be done. And they were looking at it as a symbol of what blacks could do for themselves. So this was huge symbolically for those who desired freedom.
By the way, we should mention that it was Quakers in Ohio and Indiana who stepped forward with the thousands of dollars necessary to purchase this land up in Canada. I mean, the Quakers, time and time again in our history, can be lauded for such generosity.
Well, not just in the U.S. and Canada, but also in that British movement, worked to abolish the slave trade in Britain. They also, the Quakers were also involved in that first anti-slavery movement very strongly with both action and financial support. So, yes, the Quakers have been the backbone of this whole movement from the beginning.
Hmm. As we read about some of these other communities in Canada, one of the things that, of course, is really striking is that famous names come to the fore. I mean, names like author Harriet Beecher Stowe, for instance. Tell us why her name figures so prominently in the pages of this particular chapter.
Well, Harriet Beecher Stowe wrote that marvelous book called Uncle Tom's Cabin, and it was Abraham Lincoln who actually, upon meeting Harriet Beecher Stowe, said, "So you're the little lady who started this Civil War." he actually credited her with instigating whites up north, which she absolutely did with publication of that book. However, when she published the book, she was also attacked from all directions, attacked to the point where she actually had to write almost like a rebuttal called A Key to Uncle Tom's Cabin, where she tried to prove all the different people, prove about the people, about the places, about the characteristics she was giving her characters. And upon reading the character of Uncle Tom, she actually suggested that it was certainly a composite character of blacks that she had met, but one of the blacks she suggests had a lot to do with her Uncle Tom character was a man that actually began the Dawn Institute, a formerly enslaved person who self-emancipated himself and his family, and his name was Josiah Henson. So here we have a character in a book by the name of Uncle Tom, who actually was based in large part on a real person by the name of Josiah Henson, who began the Dawn Institute. And this is huge. If you go into Canada today, if you go into the community of Dresden, just outside of it, you can actually go visit the real Uncle Tom's Cabin, which is Josiah Henson's family cabin.
He is an extraordinary figure, isn't he? I mean, so charismatic, a man of such creativity and skill and courage. I mean, what a marvelous person this is.
Well, all those attributes and more have to be credited to Josiah Henson. He escaped with his four children, carrying two of them on his back. He became a very instrumental in establishing this manual training school in Dawn called the British American Institute. He certainly became a leader of his community. He was a Prince Hall Mason. He was a minister. He actually eventually met Queen Victoria. He was certainly the prototype for a black man, the likes of which, when Harriet Beecher Stowe wrote Uncle Tom's Cabin, Southern slave owners almost refused to believe that such a black man could exist. And this was some of the outrage when she wrote her book, is that she was giving humanistic, family-loving traits to black people that heretofore had not been acknowledged in black folks.
How many communities are we ultimately talking about that are settled in Canada? And how many of them were ultimately thriving communities that lived on for many years?
Well, we're not talking about that many. We're talking about four or five, maybe six, and I mentioned those in the book.
Right.
There were other settlements that I don't go into because of time and interest and other reasons, but I centered this book only on the Ontario region for the most part. But we have the Dawn settlement, we have Wilberforce, but we also have one of the most successful settlements, and that was the Buxton settlement, or the Elgin Association. And that one was based, again, right outside, about 60 miles up from Detroit, and it still exists today. The community of North Buxton still is there today, and the descendants are still farming the lands and living on lands that their ancestors lived on from the time of the first settlement there in 1849.
Jacqueline Tobin's fascinating book is titled From Midnight to Dawn, The Last Tracks of the Underground Railroad, published by Doubleday. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, two exciting interviews, one of them with actress and